Rocky King from the Insurance Pool Governing Board is going to be here and talk about the FEOP, or the Family Health Insurance Assistant Program. That's what we're going to be dealing with today. And the notebook that we have before us is really impressive, and thank you very much for bringing all this information. And I know that because we are so knowledgeable over here that your eight-hour presentation to the House side you can do with us in only about an hour and a half. So welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is the state's high-risk health insurance pool, and also the Insurance Pool Governing Board. I want to take a minute just to tell you a little bit about what's in the book, so that at some point, if you have questions or if you would like to refer to it later, you have some indication of what we've put together. And we actually put this together for Representative Westland's Committee on Audit and Human Resources. I'm not sure what the name is there. We have too many names for the health committees right now. And over a series of 4 2-hour sessions, we went through basically most of what's in this book in the slideshow presentation. But Section 1, I have some information which is more detailed than I'm going to give you today on the Insurance Governing Board and Agency Overview. I believe during the interim, Senator Minnis' committee on the Oregon Health Plan had an opportunity to spend some time with that overview. Section 2 is FEOP guidelines. If you want to see what the income levels are of people that we subsidize, both by hourly, monthly, and annually based on family size, we have some information there. The next three sections, Section 3 through 5, are some studies that are national studies looking at private health insurance. And one of the things...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Senator. I had a question on the, I guess it's Section 2. Who are the non-qualified non-citizens, or who are the qualified non-citizens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, generally you're talking about someone who is a resident of the United States or of Oregon for our program, and who has been here for 5 years or more, but does not have U.S. citizenship. There are a variety of exceptions to that, people that serve in the military, that have only been here for 3 years or 2 years or whatever, but generally it's someone that has been in the United States for a period of 5 years, is a citizen, or excuse me, a resident of the state, but is not a U.S. citizen.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sections 3 through 5, as I started to say, are some national statistics on private health insurance and what's going on in the market. And I will tell you the phrase that I used at the former committee is that the grass is brown on both sides of the fence. If we want to talk about some of the crises we have within state government in terms of providing the public health care programs that we have, that same crisis is existing throughout this country with both large and small employers as well as individuals in terms of being able to maintain and access health care because of the rising costs and the difficulty that businesses are having in the recession as well as the state of Oregon. Section 6 is a glossary of terms, and I will try not to use acronyms, but every once in a while somebody says, well, what is a defined benefit plan, or what is a cafeteria plan? And we've really given a glossary of terms that if you ever need to get to it, we think is very helpful. Section 7 is very interesting. It's health insurance mandates. You will probably have a variety of bills this session that deal with either subtracting or adding insurance mandates for the private sector. And the Section 7 is a pretty good summary prepared by the Insurance Division as to what mandates are required in the state of Oregon, and also it looks at 3 or 4 major studies throughout the country about the cost of those mandates, both a 1990 study in Oregon as well as some more recent ones throughout the country. Section 8 is going, it lays out a request for proposal that the insurance pool governing board made and entered into a contract with Lewin Associates out of Washington, D.C. to do the first definitive close look at group health employer-based coverage within Oregon. We really want to find out what employers provide it, which ones don't, where are they, what are their wage scales, what kind of benefits, what are the contributions on the part of the employer, the employee, do they provide coverage for dependents. We're really going to get a detailed look, and this is through a grant we received from the Robert Woods Johnson Foundation, and we're matching that with some federal funds that are going to allow us to start on this. We had hoped to start earlier, but we didn't get notice on the waiver until November, and we didn't want to expend the funds unless we got the federal waiver to expand FEOP, which I'll talk about. But we hope that by June that we'll have some pretty good figures and some preliminary ones, hopefully in the months before that, that can aid some of the legislature and the governor in maybe making some policy decisions down the road. The next three sections, 9 through 11, are some studies put out by the Institute of Medicine that really talk about the value of health insurance. It does make a difference if you're covered. You will generally live longer. You will generally live healthier if you have access to an insurance product. It doesn't speak, I think, to comparing public and private as much as it just what's the value of insurance. Section 12 is an Oregon medical insurance pool, high-risk pool stat pack. Statistical pack gives you a history of the pool of enrollment and losses if you have some interest in that. Section 13, or health insurance statistics, put out by the insurance division. If you want to see who provides health insurance in this state, what carriers, what their enrollment is, whether it's in large group or small group, and small group for the purposes of their forms is 50 or less employees. That's called CHI, Small Employer Health Insurance. Portability, Medicare risk, Medicare cost contracts, individual market, really gives you a good picture, I think, of who the major carriers, major players are in the state. And Section 14 is a Family Health Insurance Assistance Program member handbook. I won't go into any detail on that, but if you I always challenge people, if you want to find out how hard it is to get through the maze of health insurance, get your PEB booklet, get an OHP booklet, get our booklet, go home, have two glasses of wine before you eat, sit down at a table and try to fill the stuff out and understand it. It gets pretty complicated, but part of that complication comes from our need to try to make sure that the right people get into the program. So that's kind of just an overview of the book. There's also a printout on a state-by-state, the state of states, which kind of gives you a picture of what other states are doing around some of the public programs and Medicaid. I will just tell you that Oregon, again, is not alone. The line of Medicaid expenditures is going up in almost every state, and the line of revenues is going down in almost every state. And then we provided you, I think, with some additional information on the high-risk pool benefit structure. Sure. And Kelly, is there anything I left out? And then some brochures that we use for both individuals as well as the business community. So that is kind of an overview. What I'd like to have you do is turn to Section 15, which is the slide presentation. It is an extensive one. We're going to just focus on FEOP today, which I believe begins at slide 51, and it's entitled the Insurance Pool Governing Board. Excuse me, is it slide 51? Make sure. That is correct. Slide 51, which would be page 26.
Or it's page 17 of the other handout. It's available.
That's correct. On the handout that has three slides on it, it would be page 17, Marjorie?
Yes.
Oh, you didn't make notebooks for everybody?
You know, Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Mr. King for this notebook. Mm-hmm. Representative Westland indicated when he was here that this was an awesome piece of work, and he's right. This is very, very good.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Okay, here we go. Page 26. I'm going to give you just a real brief overview of the agency, and then we'll get into the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program in more detail. The acronym I will use for Family Health Insurance Assistance Program is FEOP. And although we don't like to use acronyms, we are, because we're trying to brand that name. When we go out and work with employers, we don't want them to try to remember the whole name. We just want them to remember FEOP. And if you've seen any of our ads on television with Bill Shonley, it's FEOP. He does a pretty good job with it, but it's been a pleasure working with him. IPGB, Insurance Pool Governing Board, really has three major components to it. The first one is information marketing and outreach, and we've been doing that since 1987 to 89 when you first established that agency. We do agent and stakeholder training. We've trained over, I think it is, 1,200 health insurance agents and community and state folks that work around health care issues just in the last 3 months around some of the OHP2 expansion, our programs, insurance market reforms. We have an agent referral program. If a business or an individual is looking to purchase health insurance, and very often they end up on our phone line, through our training of agents throughout the state, we have a list of between 250 and 275 agents. So if somebody calls us from Roseburg and says, you know, I'm a small business, I don't know what to do, we can say, you know, there are three or four agents in your community, would you like us to hook you up with one? And if, and we make these agents go through our training so they know all aspects of both the public and private sector programs, and we'll make a direct referral, either calling the agent and having them call the business, or giving the agent's name and number to the business or the individual. We have people all the time that call up that just are falling between the cracks in public and private programs. And very often when you're sitting here in Salem, you can't help somebody in Burns very well, or you can't help somebody in Northeast Portland, but if we've got an agent there, we can hook them up with, they very often can help them through that health care maze. Doesn't mean they get into a private health insurance plan very often. It may be they can't afford it, and they get them to the local DHS office to look at whatever public resources they may have. It's been a big part of our program for a long time, and primarily focused on businesses as opposed to individuals. We also do a variety of publications. For example, the Business Center, Oregon Business Center, sends out about 3,000 packets a month for people that are looking at starting a business or coming to Oregon, and we include information about all the different programs and elements of health insurance in the state of Oregon as a part of that mail out, and I think it's about 3,000 a month that we do. Customer service. I've got four workers and we that answer phones, and we get between 1,600 and 1,700 calls. Actually, we set a record last week, 1,900 calls a week between these four workers from individuals, businesses around health care. Now, a lot of these are people that have applied to our programs. Some of these people that are Medicaid-eligible folks that are just looking for the right phone number or the right person to talk to about getting health insurance, large number of small businesses, individuals just trying to figure out how to access some health care. So one of our biggest challenges right now is with our current phone system, and only four staff, we are hiring a fifth, is how do you handle the calls? The potential of the loss of the medical needy program, the potential of the benefit losses to the 100,000 Oregonians, adults that are on OHP, has left a lot of those folks scrambling to find other resources, and very often they end on the other line of our telephone hoping that we can point them in a particular direction. Very often we can, very often we can't. So that's kind of the IPGB marketing, information, and outreach, and it really has just two full-time staff, but we kind of combine with our other elements of the program to do the customer service.
Thank you. What's your percentage of success in referrals? I mean, is it 50-50, 80-20, whatever? I mean, when people call and they need help, are you... how successful?
Ms. Chair, I don't have that figure for you, but I can talk to one of our marketing staff and find out if they've got any statistics on the referrals to the agents. I can tell you that as I did some of the training with the agents. We usually don't follow up. We just don't have the staff to do it.
I understand, yeah.
The discussions I've had with the agents has been that it's very good that they have got, they put it this way, we've written a lot of business out of those referrals.
Okay.
So hooking that person up in, you know, Corvallis or mm-hmm. or Roseburg or Newburgh or Portland with an agent has
well,
sure made them happy.
Okay, good. The success of hooking them up with the agent is not what I was interested in. And I don't know that you, I don't want you to spend a lot of time doing that, so that's fine. I'm just curious if they, the agents have been successful, and so.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, to continue, the second element of the Insurance Pool Governing Board is House Bill 3126 that passed last session. You remember that Senate Bill 8 that Senator Durfler put forward that was going to kind of set up some health insurance plans that were not subject to mandates, that had a certain formula tied to family gross income to set a premium, and that the benefit package had to really follow whatever that pegged amount of money that families should have available or businesses would have available. And that failed on a 15-15 vote. But one of the bills that did come out was House Bill 3126 that directed the Insurance Pool Governing Board to get back in the business of developing low-cost benefit plans for small businesses. We've done that in 1987 through the year 2000. It was phased out between, I think, 1999 and 2000. We had about 32,000 people enrolled at its height, served over 60,000 employees and dependents over the course of that 10 years. But we phased it out, and a bill came primarily sponsored by, I think, Representative Nolan out of Portland to get us back into business. It was not going to be subject to the insurance mandates, but it must meet the FEOP benchmark, which I'll talk about. And, well, let me talk about it here. The problem with the bill that we none of us foresaw was the benchmark had to equal the plans by statute that are offered most commonly in the small business market. All those plans had mandates. So you pass a bill that says develop a plan that doesn't meet mandates, but by the way, it has to at least equal the plans that do meet mandates. It was a paradox that the board felt itself in, so we've kind of put those on hold. There's nothing that we can do right now, and I believe that there's going to be further proposals before either the Senate or the House side that either address this bill or kind of start anew and say, let's relook at this. And I think AOI and NFIB are working with some of the folks to do this now. Okay. Now, we'll get into FEOP. And that will start with slide 28. First enacted in 1997, and the rationale behind it was there were some House members, primarily I think Representative Patty Milne, Republican from Marin County, who in working with small business folks were trying to find a way that many of their low-income employees could afford their share of the premiums to purchase health insurance, and also recognition that there are hundreds of thousands of Oregonians that aren't enrolled in the public program that didn't qualify because they earned too much money, yet were paying the taxes to support Medicaid, Medicare, and support businesses' deductions for health insurance, but yet they themselves could not afford health insurance. The example I give is a single individual that works for McDonald's full-time at minimum wage does not qualify for OHP. That's over 100% of the federal poverty level, not by much, but it is over. So they were trying to give recognition to those low-income workers out there, minimum wage workers that hopefully could find some help in purchasing health insurance. We implemented in May of 1998. First enrollments were July of 1998, and our first target was about 15,000 individuals.
Okay, let me interrupt you, but you mentioned McDonald's or fast food restaurants, and it occurs to me a lot of employees in fast food restaurants simply do not work there longer than 6 months. And I read an article they oftentimes they will offer health insurance, but most employees don't qualify because they're not there long enough to actually get to that level. Is that congruent with what you know? Or?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think that you could say that for the restaurant business, and in the piece I talk about why small employers don't offer health insurance, one of the biggest reasons is high turnover of employees. Those industries that have high turnover, low wage, generally will not offer. But let me give you an example of one in Salem. Kinko's. Minimum wage for most of their staff, they pay for almost all of the cost for the employee. I think it's like $17 or $20 a month the employee puts in. And this is minimum wage employees. The employer puts in the remaining. Except for dependent coverage, there is no contribution. So you've got some firms that do provide for low-wage workers insurance opportunities, pay for the majority of the employee, but aren't able to pay for any dependent coverage. So restaurants is maybe a little skewed because it is high turnover. Some of the agriculture is another example of high turnover where you may offer it, but people aren't there long enough.
I guess the follow-up question is: do you know whether or not if insurance was offered earlier that people might stay in employment longer? Is it the motivation to stay in employment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think we know that there are four or five reasons that people offer insurance. One is to recruit. And in the kind of labor market we have right now, you don't need a lot of benefits to recruit because there are a lot of people looking for jobs. The second, though, is retaining. And there is, I think, enough evidence nationally to say that it does assist in the retaining of folks. And the third is just the productivity, that you have a healthier workforce. There are two other reasons that often aren't mentioned. One is collective bargaining. Sometimes employers just provide it because they're unionized workers, and that's what they've bargained for. And the fourth is just social obligation. It has nothing to do with getting employees. It's just the employer thinks it's right. An example of that out here is Leighton Manufacturing, that's provided health benefits to their employees for 35 years out here on Turner Road. It's not that they can't hire a welder. There are a lot of welders out there right now, and they're not union, but they've always thought it was the right thing to do. The problem is thinking it's the right thing to do in today's market where you see premium increases of 20, 30, 40%. That's why you see a lot of the pullback on employment-based coverage. One of the things I didn't talk about, and Senator Minnis, this gets to some of the discussions that you had during the intro. When you look at Oregon's uninsured rate, in 1990, when it went from 18% down to, I think, 10.8% at the low. It's come back up to 14. We saw that decrease in uninsurance rate while we saw the state grow about 400,000 people in terms of population. What caused that decrease in rate was not that we added 100 or 125,000 people into the public sector. It was the expansion in the private sector. We saw Oregon's businesses, as a percentage of businesses offering health insurance, increase. We saw employment-based coverage increase. So that 400,000 or 500,000 people that got insurance during that 10-year period really was primarily from the private sector. So as we debate, and one of the messages I always give is when we debate some of the reforms and discussions about the public sector side, we always have to remember the hydraulic effect on the private side. And there is, it runs both ways.
Okay. Now, I guess I missed that last part of the year from during the 90s, right? Okay, but that was when times were good. The economy was good. And the rates were probably lower. And now that things have changed, the insurance company may not have the cushion that they had then to operate on. So the rates, that might be the reason for the rates going up.
Mr. Chair, I am a firm believer that the rise in the uninsurance rate is directly related to the economy.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Directly.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I say
now,
that.
Maybe I missed something also. Where did that go then from the high? Did you mention the drop-off?
Mr. Chair, in 1990 it was about 18%. I believe in 1996 was the low point at about 10.8%. And I wish I could take you through it, because one of the things you would see in there is that was the lowest period of time we saw premium inflation also. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was under 10% in terms of premiums that were being charged individuals and businesses was in 1996. Premiums started to rise in 1996, and you can just see the uninsurance rates start going up at the same time. Yeah. Oh. And during that same period, the public sector programs expanded a little bit, but nothing like what was happening in the private sector market. Now, we've seen the uninsurance rate get to that 10.8. It's back to 12% in the year 2000, and I think the estimates are at about 14% right now. And again, most of that is through loss of private coverage, not public coverage. FEOP, again, we'll start there. We're on, I believe, page 28 on the left-hand side, slide 55 and 56. So we started in 1998, July. Primary focus was about 15,000 people. Quickly cut back to 7,500 because of some of the budget problems we started to see in the 97 and 99 sessions. And we did a pretty good job of enrolling about 6,000 folks in 99. We had to cut it back to about 5,500 because of loss of dollars. But it was general fund only. And I think that's key, because as long as it remained general fund, it was very vulnerable because of the general fund shortage throughout the state, irrespective of what area of state programs you were looking at. So the legislature, in working with the governor, passed House Bill 2519 in the year 2001, which really directed the Department of Human Services to obtain federal waivers, and I'll focus primarily on FEOP here, but to really give some management capability for the public side, but also to get federal dollars so that we could expand FEOP. And we were down to about 4,500 folks at that point. And the legislation, and in working with the emergency board, really directed the IPGB to expand FEOP to 25,000 people. Key thing is that most of the expansion was out of 60,000 was still going to occur on the public side, but IPGB FEOP program was substantial in that it would get 25,000 additional folks with a total enrollment of about 30,000. We received approval in October of 2002, and we're ready to expand November 1. Now, we turned the little switch on the expansion, but we really didn't see any enrollment going up, because it takes 3 to 4 months to really get the program out there and marketed and the people trained. But we were actually taking in the federal dollars on November 1 of this year.
Yes.
Rocky, what's the potential population of persons that could be insured under the FEOP scheme?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, there are two groups. You have those that have group coverage available to them and those who do not have group coverage available to them. And I'm going to ask Kelly Harms to throw up her hand here if I give bad numbers. She's the policy and communications manager and helped put this book together. But it's about 100. What page is the chart on? Page 7. Page 8, top slide, total uninsured population. This is based on the 2000 statistics. We have about 80 or 90,000 additional Oregonians that are uninsured, but we don't have the detail yet from the progress board. But that'll basically shows you that you've got about 145,000 above 200% of poverty. And those could be folks that probably could go out and buy insurance but have just chosen not to. You have under 100%, about 120,000 Oregonians. And between 100 and 200%, you have about 154,000 Oregonians. the question that we have and that we're trying to get answered with the Lewin study is, of those 154, how many of those have group coverage available to them but just have not either elected it because they couldn't afford it, or for what reasons they haven't elected it? And that's what we want to focus in on with that study.
Well, I'm not sure I'm clear on the answer, though. You got a total uninsured population in the year 2000, this is 2003, 422,000. FEOP wouldn't apply to all of those people.
That is correct, Senator. FEOP expansion initially was 25,000 of those individuals.
But I'm assuming if you had all the money in the world, in other words, if you had an open checkbook and you could match it with federal money, how large could this program get in terms of who's potentially insurable? Because there has to be an employer, I'm assuming, because we're subsidizing insurance.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, you have two roads you can go down with FEOP. One is the individual market, one is the group market. Yeah. So if everyone, if these figures are correct and everyone wanted to get it, and we could put them either in an individual plan or the group-based plan, then your target is 154,000, although there are still very many people under 100% that would also want to come into this program. And the example I use is we have about 23% of the people that enroll in FEOP right now that are under 100% of the federal poverty level, who rather than going into Medicaid have chosen, or HP Medicaid, have chosen to do the private sector.
Right, and actually that's the group that I'm trying to, I guess, incent by my support for it, is that because those are persons that choose to go to work, even though they're in a low-wage job, because they're making progress towards, I guess, what's the right word, self-sufficiency of some sort. Okay. So I'm going to guess about 200,000 or somewhere in that ballpark. I have a purpose for the question.
I'm sure you do.
A little bill I'm introducing.
Oh,
it's universal health care for the self-sufficient. Right?
There you go.
Good.
Okay, we are still on page 28, or actually 29. One of the things I like to do is to kind of remind us that when we put FEOP in front of the legislature and in some of the committees and groups that Representative Milne and the governor's office put together, we wanted to lay out some key principles of the program to make sure that everybody kind of agreed on the principles, because it was the principles that would really guide us in terms of the design of the program. And I just want to go through those. First of all, we wanted to build on the strength of the current private market system. Almost 67 or 68% of those who have coverage in the state of Oregon, if you take out Medicare and Medicaid, have coverage in the private sector. It, you know, has a lot of glitches, especially now in with the economy the way it is, but it has been a very successful market in delivering health care services to most Oregonians. The other thing is we wanted to say is it's not an entitlement. We have limited dollars. When the we don't rebalance every quarter or every month. When you say we have X number of dollars to serve so many people, our assumption is that we would close the program to new enrollees when we reach those dollars, that we would not come back and ask you for more. We wanted something that fostered independence and self-reliance. That is, we have a whole host of Oregonians who make it out there in that private health care system and that are independent, who do make good decisions and have learned how to do that and to get through that maze, and we wanted to assist people in that process. The piece that I'll talk about in more detail has to do with administrative simplicity and efficiency. If there's one that we have failed at, it's, I don't want to say we failed, it's the biggest challenge we have, and I'll talk about that in a little more detail later. The other is that we wanted to extend the coverage to the uninsured. As a state, we cannot afford to take everybody between 100 and 200% and subsidize their coverage. You're talking about a potential of 500,000 to 600,000 as opposed to 154,000. We wanted to make sure subsidies were adequate. We have enough studies to show that up to 150% of poverty, there just is not a lot of money. to go out and purchase family coverage. Family coverage today can cost you from $500 to $900 a month, depending on where you are and what community. And if you are only earning $2,000 a month for two of you, a mother and a daughter, for example, it's tough to buy family coverage unless you subsidize a good portion of that. And finally, we want to promote equity in healthcare financing in Centered Minnesota. I think this gets to your comment. These are folks that are generally out there working, paying taxes, and we wanted to make sure they got some benefit through the healthcare system of feeding some of their tax dollars in. Eligibility on slide, got to get my glasses, 58. Oregon resident, citizen or qualified non-citizen, without health insurance for 6 months, investment and savings less than $10,000. Medicaid is $2,000. CHIP, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program, is $5,000. We set up FEOP as $10,000 because we wanted to give people incentives to earn more money and to save money. Because it wasn't an entitlement in that we can close intake, we weren't so concerned at that point. We knew we couldn't serve everybody, but we didn't want to penalize anybody for really trying to put money away for whatever that may be, education of the children or to buy a house. I will tell you, though, the average is less than $2,000. These folks aren't there. Those that have assets above that are generally fishermen or farmers who may get paid once during the year and have a set of cash there that has to last them till that next paycheck, which may not be 5 or 6 months down the road. Incomes under 185%, we look back 3 months. Exceptions are for self-employed farmers, fishermen, and ranchers. There are special circumstances that we look at for those folks. For example, for self-employed, we usually look at 12 months of income. 12 months of eligibility versus 6 months. One of the key things that we wanted to provide was stability. We wanted to be health care to become a back issue rather than a front issue for these families. You've got health care. You got it for 12 months. Figure out here now how you can keep a job, earn more money, and not worry about losing your coverage because you're watching your income and the number of hours that you work. One of the questions that came to me during the opening sessions was, if somebody comes in and they're eligible for 12 months and they win the lottery the next month, what do you do? And my response has always been the same. It's, I call them up on the phone and I say, congratulations, you will pay more in taxes than you will ever receive from us in subsidies, but you have eligibility for another 11 months. I want, and I would love to see everybody win the lottery, and nobody has. I don't want to say we have, but we want people not to turn down a 50-cent an hour better job or a 5-cent an hour raise. So we really said, let's provide some stability. That was also important to employers. Employers cannot afford to have people come into their plan, say, I'm no longer eligible, I got to drop out of the plan, 6 months later come back and say, I'm into the plan. So we heard from employers, give us some stability of membership into that. The next page, on page 30, top slide, gives you the income guidelines. If you are under 125% of poverty, we pay a 95% subsidy of the premium. So if your premium is for an individual $200 a month, then we will pay 190 of that, and you pay 10 plus all copays and deductibles. So we subsidize the premium, but that individual is responsible for 100% for copays and deductibles. There's one exception to that we'll talk about in a few minutes.
Sure. Yes. Again, forgive me for interrupting. What's your cost per enrollee per month, the state general fund?
Ms. Chair, Senator Minnis, can you hold with me for a couple slides because I have it all broken out for you. Yep. FEOP design features, this is part of the waiver, 50-50 split of state resources between group and individual markets. So we have 25,000 or 29,000 folks, or based on the governor's budget, about 15. Two-thirds of those have to go to the group market, one-third to the individual, and that's because the individual market costs about twice as much, almost three times as much as the group market, and I'll get to Senator Minnis's specifics in a few minutes. The other thing we said was, because the group market is so much less expensive, and it's less expensive not because the premiums as a whole are cheaper, it's because there's an employer contribution. It may still cost $200 a month for that individual, but you've got $100 a month coming from the employer. So from a state perspective, it's less expensive, and thus we wanted to make sure people enrolled in group. If no group plans available, they could go to the individual market, and both the group and individual markets had to have a benchmark benefit plan per House Bill 2519 that kind of equaled what everybody else out there was having. Challenges and opportunities, benchmark benefit plans. Next slide. It's a moving target in both group and individual markets. And give you a good example, in the Insurance Pool Governing Board in 1987 offered a $250 deductible plan for $53.33. Actually, they implemented in April of 89. By the time we phased out of that pool in 1990, that same $53.50 would buy you a $2,500 or a $3,000 deductible plan. The reality is the benchmarks and the benefit levels are changing throughout this country, and specifically in the business sectors where they're having to raise the deductibles, increase cost sharing, co-pays, and deductibles in order to be able to afford benefits. So one of our challenges is really trying to make sure that we're able to keep ahead of that benchmark. The other challenge is achieving the group market enrollments. Again, it's easy to enroll somebody on the individual market side. I have a waiting list of 14,000. I could probably put 50,000 on there if I went out and marketed it. The hard part is working with employers and getting people really keyed into that employer coverage and making sure that the carrier's okay with open enrollment periods, the employer's okay. It's going to be a challenge, and partly because we don't know which employers to go to, which communities, and that's one thing we know we're going to figure out, but it's going to be tough. Navigation of private market maze. Remember, take your two glasses of wine, try to fill out an application for health insurance. It's tough, and if you don't have a lot of experience in the health insurance arena, you are a low-income family who's never been insured, and you say, go to Blue Cross Blue Shield, get an application, and if you get turned down, go to the high-risk pool, talk to your employer about your cafeteria plan, and select the best plan for you and your family. These folks have a tough time through that maze. So we have...
Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. King, I just have to tell you that even here, when we got offered insurance, when I first came in the legislature in 99, I almost cried because I couldn't understand all of these forms, and I had staff down in employee services help me fill them out because I consider myself an intelligent woman with a college degree, but it's very difficult, so I appreciate your understanding that.
The other challenge we have is developing strategic relationships and linkages to the Oregon business community. We work with Associated Oregon Industries, the Restaurant Association, a variety of folks to try to really key in to the business sector. Administrative simplicity, consumer, employer, and state. Let me give you an example of this. When we first started this program, we told the legislature we're going to shoot for a no worse than a 5% fraud rate. We want to make it real simple for people to get in the program and just accept that we're going to have people that get in that shouldn't have gotten in. Well, it didn't take us long to look at some of the people that were slipping in to say, we're not happy with that. And so I can tell you great stories of eligibility workers sitting down in front of me and saying, Rocky, if we got more information or asked for information this way or double checked this way, this person wouldn't have gotten in. And because we have a waiting list, somebody who deserved to get in would have gotten in. And we went from, you know, the problem you have is you want people to sign a piece of paper that says, I'm poor, give me a subsidy and turn it in, and that's the easy way. The other way is when they got to submit to you 18 inches of documents to prove they're eligible. What we're trying to find is something in the middle. We found through our audit and appeal process that we have internally, for example, that it was really important for us to ask for income tax returns. You can get all the wage information you want, And you can even get bank information, but it's that income tax return from last year that shows that the person's got a residence that they've rented out in Newburg, or that they've got stock and bond interest and dividends. So we've started asking for a lot more information from folks. I should tell you, by the way, we never felt fraud was more than 1%, even when we were really kind of, I don't want to say loose, but when we weren't as thorough in terms of the information that we required. I think we've swung the pendulum the other way, and we're asking people to really provide us with a lot of information about you know, their financial circumstances before we determine whether they're eligible or not. That makes it more difficult for them. It makes it more difficult for the employer. It makes it more difficult for us. But it's the only way we can ensure that those people that are truly eligible for the program get into the program. The other problem and challenge we have is the political uncertainty of the state budget. We hear every time we go out into the community and sit down with an employer and say, you know, we've got a way to help some of your lower wage employees afford their share of the premium, for example, for dependent coverage. Their response is, yeah, you enroll them and you pull out your funding for it because of your crisis, and then I'm left holding the bag. I can't afford to do that. So we think that over the next 4 or 5 months, until really decisions are made in the legislature about the budgets, it's going to be a tough sell out there. It's tough to go out and say we're expanding, we're open, at the same time we're reading the paper, we're retracting, we're closing. So we really need to get that going. The other is reverse disparity between adult private versus public sector health care benefits. For 12 years, I've been hearing nothing but anger on the part of agents and small businesses that the Oregon Health Plan provided a richer package than anybody had in the commercial sector. Well, now, because of all the cutbacks, we're starting to see the reverse of that. That maybe the private sector, I'm not talking about mandatory Medicaid population, but certainly the standard population, with the cutback in dental and the prescription drugs and the mental health and all that's there, you finally have some disparity going towards the private side. It's a better package in the private side. Now, that may be good. It may incentivize more people to go to the private side, but it does create, again, the ledge no matter which way you go. Administrative cost. It is very difficult for me to sit in front of you and say this is a great program, and if I'm only serving 4,000 or 5,000 people, it's not worth the administrative cost. And at 25,000 enrollments, we were going to be between, I think, 7% and 8% for an administrative cost. The governor's recommended budget, or balanced budget, that knocks that back to about 15,000 in terms of the expansion. Our administrative cost gets to about 13%. As you know, our responsibility as administrator to say is that's a pretty fine line. That means for every dollar, 13 cents we're running the program, and 87 cents is ending up in benefits. And all that is almost all eligibility. I mean, eligibility is the major portion of that.
Yes.
Isn't the reverse true, though? If you expand the audience and the participants, your administrative costs go down.
Goes down. That is correct, Senator. But it's something that we have to kind of, you know, keep track of. There's a point at which you just say it costs too much to run the program, to give the program, find another way to deliver that service. And I think we're okay, but we're marginal. And I have a responsibility to you and to, you know, the people we serve, to make sure we get as many dollars out to them as possible. The other is the inequity between the group market and the individual market. Out of that 154,000, you have 25 or 30,000 have group coverage. The rest don't. I've got a waiting list for individual. I'm out there begging for people to enroll in group. And just because someone works for an employer that does not provide coverage, that means their access is closed compared to those that do have group coverage. I know time is key here, so I'm going to I'm going to go through slide 63, and then I want to get to the dollars and some of the enrollment figures that Senator Minnis talked about. Prospective versus reimbursement in group market. when we first started this program, we said somebody that earns $1,200 a month can't afford $300 out of their paycheck and wait 2 weeks to get reimbursed. So we actually paid people before they had the payroll deductions from their group, from their employer. So if somebody, we worked with the employer would say they're going to have $300 deducted out of their check, $250 of that we were going to subsidize. So we actually sent them a check a week before it was deducted. And there wasn't any fraud in the sense of people taking the money and run. It's that when people terminated from the program, generally because their income went too high, they always owed us 1 month worth of subsidy. And we found we were spending more time collecting 1 month's worth of subsidies. That it just was very, very difficult in terms of staff. So we changed to reimbursement, which meant when you get paid, it's deducted, fax us your thing, and we'll write you a check. And that'll get to you in 2 or 3 days. In today's environment, it's very hard for employees to believe us when we say we're going to send them money.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Can you do direct deposit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, that is an option that we hope to implement in the next...
Where are we on that, Kelly?
I think there is some delays administratively through DAS in being able to implement that.
But we are exploring it and trying to work on it.
Is that because they're confused at DAS, or is there some other problem?
I think it's a funding issue.
Really?
It's a what issue?
A funding issue.
For their staff support?
Yes.
That seems rather ridiculous. That sounds like a typical DAS response.
The other thing that we are looking at, Senator Minnis, is working with the employers. Some employers are saying that we'll front the money, just reimburse us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we really are looking at a variety of different ways of working with employers to what's easiest for the employee and the employer. We believe we're going to go back to some of the prospective payments. It just... As long as we've got cooperation from the employer, we're not as concerned about getting that money into the hands of that individual. The last thing is the impact on the OMIP assessment. The high-risk pool is funded primarily through premiums, with losses about 40 cents in each dollar coming from an assessment of health insurers. About 25% of those that go into the FEOP program end up in the high-risk pool. 50 years old, 70% female, chronic health conditions. And those people are funded with the basically through losses through the assessment of health insurers. And we have a bill, House Bill 2189, that's going to allow us to utilize federal dollars, match those assessments, so the burden isn't as high on health insurers as it has been over the last few years. Getting to slide 33, the FEOP program snapshot. Currently, we have, just before we implemented in November, I had 2,700 people left in the program. We purposefully closed it to let the enrollment come down because we could get better use of the federal dollars with all the new people. So we got to about 2,700. We are up to about 3,336 since November 1. Remember, economic times, Christmas, Thanksgiving, and winter is the worst time we could market this program. We really, even though we did training, we've started doing the outreach, radio, and television, you're not going to see that really take hold into probably March and April. But in addition to those 3,300, which are about 650 more than we had a month and a half ago, we have another almost 1,600 that we've approved that are out there signing up for their group health insurance or individual health insurance. Which would put us close to 5,000 actually enrolled, and with an additional 434 applications that are under review. And that's applications when we represent about 800 people. A reservation list, and it's actually reservation list and applications that we have sent out are at about 15,000. So we still have a backlog of folks that theoretically could add to that figure. Almost all of those are people without group coverage. We've gone through and pulled out the group coverage members.
Didn't you say earlier that the budget will allow you to do 15,000? Is that is what I heard.
Ms. Chair, right now it's about 15,000, and on the next page, page 35, you can see where group enrollment will be about 11,000. That's slide 69, and approximately 3,600 an individual. That would bring us to about 14,600. And again, it depends on the costs of those individuals.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
And we're using tobacco settlement money for the match, the federal match, currently. Is that right?
No. Ms. Chair, Senator Minnis, this year it is tobacco settlement money. Next year it'll be general fund.
So that makes it even more
susceptible.
Susceptible.
Yes. So they switched to general fund in the budget and the governor's balanced budget.
Okay.
On the next page, you can see the demographics and the costs, and I'll spend a few minutes on that. Demographics, about 30% of the enrollments are children, which always amazes us, because these are folks that generally would qualify for the state Medicaid OHP CHIP program. Male, about 40%, female, about 60%. In the group market, 50% of the enrollments are kids. These are parents that generally want to keep their child with them enrolled in the group plan, as opposed to having someone in OHP Medicaid and somebody in the private sector. The primary reason why more adults do not enroll their children in the group market, even more than the 50%, is because very often there's no dental coverage, which in the public program for children there is dental coverage. Program costs, and this gets to Senator Minnis' question. I'll walk through this with you. First of all, we're on slide 68. The member share, an average premium in the group market, the employee is being charged $98. If you look at the subsidy in the next big bullet down, we subsidize $87 of that. Their contribution, if you look at the next bullet for group market, is 14. The employer is putting up 93. So it's about a 50-50 split, 50% for the employee and the state, and 50% for the employer. That's very different if you look at the average subsidy for the individual non-OMIP market. It's 166. For the OMIP market, it's 317. The weighted average is about 181. I want to remind you, the OMIP market is very different than either the group or the individual in terms of the demographics. The OMIP market for this population is average age, over 50 years old, 70% female, chronic health conditions. And that's why the cost of
$317.
Yes.
This program, I don't know if it's been around long enough to know whether that demographic percentage split in total population would stay the same over time. And I guess what I'm saying is it predictable? Could you blend all of these and say, well, the average cost is X? And it would pretty much stay at X. You blend these rates, basically. In other words, whatever percentage of persons you have in the high-risk pool, those individuals in the group or in the individual policies, are those percentages pretty much demographically stuck?
Ms. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think the one difference is if you were open, so you weren't closed. Being closed kind of changes things. And the reason for that is the OMIP people are going to typically stay in their plans longer because they have chronic health conditions. So when we first started OMIP, for example, right now it's 23-24% of our enrollment. It started off about 18 or 19%. But because we haven't been able to take new folks, that as a percentage has gone up as the others have dropped off.
Would the reverse be true if the other side was expanded? You'd have less of the people with chronic illnesses and more of an in the general insurance population. Okay. So the cost actually goes down. The average cost goes down to the extent that the program grows.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, if it grows and we're able to penetrate the group market, because the group market is the most inexpensive.
Are you going to talk about the group market? I'm not sure what that dynamic is, how you get people in group markets as opposed to individual markets, or maybe you said it and I just didn't pick up on it.
Yeah, there are several things that I have questions about, but what I want to know is this particular slide must be explained in greater detail somewhere in this book, right?
If you look at section one,
okay.
you'll see a agency overview. And in the back of that section, if you go to page, I believe it is 22. That's in section 1, page 22. And you'll see the breakdown by age, by sex, by cost, subsidies, of all the different elements of the programs in a lot more detail.
Okay, now, my next question is, I assume that's true with every slide that you have in here, that somewhere in this... So if you go home
generally,
and read
yes.
the whole thing and keep referencing the slides...
Pretty much.
Okay, good. Well, thank you. Because I understand what you're doing today, but you are, raising issues that we need to examine more carefully so we know where to look. And you do have a phone number, right?
Mr. Chair, I have a phone number. I'm taking it off the hook, though, after today. I am trying to condense down, really, an 8-hour presentation down to 2 hours.
But I appreciate that reference to that.
Yeah, but section 1, though, which is the agency overview, does give you, I think, a lot more detail in this. And to get to Senator Minnis's question about the group market, I just spent yesterday 2 hours with the three staff that are responsible for marketing this program. And I don't like to use the word marketing, but that's what we do because that's what the private sector uses, and whether it's outreach or whatever. But very sophisticated, because you're working with unions. You're working with the agent community, the carrier community, small business, large business. Small and large business are very different. You're talking about HR directors with businesses of 15 or more, and you're talking about an owner who doesn't want to talk to you with 50 or less. You're talking about folks that are concerned about the state budget. Some that don't care whether their employees have health insurance or not. Some that really are trying to work with you to figure out a way to provide that health insurance. The problem that you have is when you have only three or four folks, well, we have three in this case, is getting out there, because what we're finding is sitting down with them is what makes a difference. And explaining the program, helping them through the paperwork. Every employer has to fill out what's called an employer verification form, which is who's the company, what are the benefits to make sure it meets the benchmark, what do you charge in premiums, what does the employee pay, what do you pay, and once we get that information, then we can figure out how much we're going to pay the employer. Sitting down with an employer, a large employer, who says, well, I'll fax you all the wage information a month in advance, or a day in advance, send me the check, and don't worry about fronting them the money, I'll front them the money. Then the next employer says, I'll fill out this form once, but I don't want to talk to you. It's just every employer is different in their perspective and how they want to work with you.
Mr. Chair, I was thinking, because I had a small business for a period of time, a couple of years, and minimum wage, basically employees. But the one thing that was missing, when you go to a number of places to get your business licenses and you get your corporate names and blah, 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 was any access to information on where do you go to get health coverage. Even if you wanted to provide it, it was like, I didn't know where to go. There was no one place that said, hey, if you want to provide health insurance for your employees, here's a place you could go and get, even price it and try to fit it into your business plan and the budget you're trying to put together for your cash flow model and all of that. So, that is an area that maybe employers would, if they had access to the information about what's available and where to get it.
Yeah, Ms. Chair, in fact, Senator Minnis, we are working with the Employment Department. We've identified approximately 1,800 employers in the state that account for, Kelly, 59%, 60%?
57%.
How much?
57%
of Oregon employees work for 1,800 employers out of 90,000? 96,000 employers. So one of the things that we're doing is targeting those large employers, and primarily all those employers have HR departments. So we're targeting those folks. We're providing them with information about the program, who to call, making offers to come out and sit down with them. We just made a tour of Eastern Oregon where they sat down with five or six of the major employers, the HR departments, Goodwill. Mm-hmm. Sit down with the HR department. So we're trying that that angle.
I just, Mr. Chairman, again, I of course carried workers' comp through, I think, ALI comp wise with my business, but I mean, you clearly got a lot of information from you know, ALI comp wise in that particular program, but you know, as a member of NFIB, but again, the health insurance side of it, there was a huge void of information. So maybe we need to do something to incent providing that kind of information. If you're a small business person, you're supposed to have workers' comp insurance. I mean, you have to, some don't, but maybe providing access to health insurance information through the workers' comp system, even though they are different, it is maybe a window of getting access to information to employers.
So kind of saying, Senator, if I may put it in my words for a minute, you don't necessarily have to provide it, the health insurance, but one of the things you may have to do is have a vehicle by which your employees can find out about health insurance.
Or maybe a list of websites or you know, statewide known health care providers, an average health care cost per employee or something of that nature that gives an employer a tool to look at to say, well, you know what, if it's a cost of $300 a month, maybe I can work that into my compensation package. Maybe it becomes part of my model.
How large is your insurance agent base?
Mr. Chair, there are about 8,000 health insurance agents in the state. Probably about 98% of the group business is written by, I would imagine, less than 1,500 of those. And we have on our agent referral list probably about, I think it's 250 agents right now.
So an agent referral list could be helpful, right?
Sure.
But who would do that?
Pardon?
Okay.
Yeah. Now, I did tell you, Ms. Chair, I think that once a month we do send out about 3,000 brochures on health insurance that gives a variety of numbers, describes the agent referral program to all the new businesses that are... It's actually individuals as well as businesses that inquire about starting a business or have just started a business through the Business Information Center. And it does list web pages for us in the insurance division so that folks can access health insurance information. But that's not existing businesses. That's really people that are just starting.
Let's say, Mr. Chairman, you know, someone once said repetition is the mother of skill. And so actually the more places that employers might see this information,
the better they are.
It's worth a bet.
Well, I'm just not sure where to go here other than I do have a slide I really like, and it's on page 36 when people say what other states are doing, and it's the boat. Every state is fighting the same challenge that we're fighting, and that's how to keep the public sector programs alive or to alter them so that they can get through this economic times. All the way to the private sector side, which is how do we maintain a viable private sector market. If you close down the public side, those folks still get served in the highest cost areas of the hospital, which is primarily the emergency room. And instead of getting the medication, they get treated for the stroke, and that gets cost shifted over to the private side. Likewise, the private side starts to drop coverage because they can't afford it. It pushes people over to the public side where they can't afford it. It is very much a hydraulic effect between the two. And when Oregon has been the most successful, it's when they've created an environment that the private side could expand as the population grew and made it easier for businesses to do business in the state and purchase health insurance while at the same time backing up that system, addressing some of the most vulnerable populations that weren't going to be addressed by the private side. But every state's in the same boat. The brown is, or the grass is brown on both sides of the fence.
If this is a level 3 rapid or a level 5 rapid.
It's a level 5 rapid.
Because if it's a level 3 rapid, I think we're in trouble. But if it's level 5, I can see the boat going over.
That's a quick overview in, you know, an hour of again, what is generally a lot longer discussion. But I'm happy to answer questions or go through any of these other sections if you want.
Any questions?
Well,
Senator,
I do. And I'm not sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really not sure where I want to go with this question. But I just got pulled out, so I talked to some nurses from OHSU to tell me about their transplant patients who are going to die in 3 days because they're losing their medication. And we don't have money in the budget to make sure these people stay alive. And one of the things they argued with me was this FEOC program and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool and all these wonderful programs that we offer in our state, which I think are great. So maybe it's just a policy question that you can't answer, but in the FEOC program, you don't allow a transplant patient, you have to be uninsured for 6 months before you can get into the program. A transplant patient can't be without medication and be uninsured for 6 months because of the cost. So they have a hard time getting into the program. And now we're expanding the program, which costs money to expand it. Correct, Mr. King? So I'm just a little concerned. I like what we're doing here, but I'm also concerned about what we're doing to the people who are going to die next week. And I don't know that you can answer that.
Ms. Chair, Senator Walker, I think that this, I mean, therein lies the rub of all these programs. I talk to people every day that are in situations that if they don't get health care, they're going to die. A lot of those people are in the FEOC program. Some of those people are in the medical need program. Some of those people are in the OHB standard program. And even when they're in the program, they die. I don't have the answers. It is just a tough dilemma. Now, I will tell you I'd be very surprised if there are a lot of people working on gathering the resources together to help bridge some of these folks that are going to run out of medications in 3 days. But that's one of the outcomes of these budget cuts. One of the hard things for me to argue at times is the FEOC program that subsidizes the purchase of private health care while we're cutting back some of the public side. But I will tell you that I've got somebody in a FEOC at 110% of the poverty that has multiple sclerosis. And how are they different than somebody at 95% of the poverty level that has heart disease? We're talking about 20% difference in federal poverty levels. You're talking about less than $100 of income for each of those families. Who's more vulnerable? I don't know. I'm not sure. But let me tell you about some of the people that we do enroll. Tell you the good stories. The man a number of months ago who called us up and said, I just got my redetermination of your eligibility. I've been in the program for a year. I had a 95% subsidy. You redetermined my eligibility, and I continue to get a 95% subsidy. He says, but you know what? In the last 3 months, when I sent in my income, I took 2 weeks off. And during those 2 weeks, it was unpaid vacation. But it was my choice. If I would have worked those 2 weeks and you would have redetermined my eligibility, I would have got a 70% subsidy. Please move me down from a 95 to a 70% subsidy. I know you don't have a lot of money, and maybe this can help somebody else get into the program. I don't care if they're people that earn 150% of the federal poverty level or 10% or 50% or 75%. One of the most overwhelming things about this program is the great people that we have in this state. We always hear about the abusers and the fraud. What we don't hear about is the 99% that are out there, Oregonians, working, trying to make a living, paying their taxes, that just get in a bind, who maybe for whatever reason, because it's life skills, because of a medical condition, don't earn the income that you and I do to afford health insurance. And it's just our responsibility to take whatever's in the box and divide it up as most equitably as we can. And I don't have any answer as to who deserves it more than another.
Well, thank you for your answer, and thank you for making me feel a little bit better. But I go home at night and cry about what we're doing here. I just appreciate your work.
Senator Minnis.
Remind me, Rocky, what's the federal match in FEOC?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, for the people that we had in the program before, that 2,700, and for people who would be generally Medicaid mandatory eligible anyway, it's a 60-40 match, 60% federal. For most of the expansion population, it's 72% federal, 28 state. It's a really nice match.
It's an awesome amount. Investment.
That last one was
72% federal match or federal funds and 28% state. So for every dollar cut, you lose that 75 cents coming from the feds. But that's true for us or the Medicaid CHIP program also.
Okay, any other questions?
I have one other question.
Yes.
Rocky, do you have any wisdom for us? I mean, first, and I say that because I know that you're a very innovative and very thoughtful person, and every presentation I've ever heard Rocky give to any committee that I've ever sat on has always been very good, very comprehensive, and I wish we could kind of duplicate you in terms of presentations. We had a very good presentation this morning in judiciary from a private attorney who practices in probate and will on dealing with the law of the sheet and stuff. It's a very boring subject, but he actually did a very, very good job of explaining it to us. I just, I think that sometimes in the legislature we don't focus on what's possible. And we don't dream enough in terms of what we can possibly do here, because we spend so much time in politics pointing fingers at each other and berating each other because of our party affiliation, etc. It's kind of the game we play. But I think this is
the dream committee.
Yeah. But this is really a session where I think that, and I think it's good for Oregon, because politically this is where I think Oregon is. I think Oregon's looking at politicians today to be persons who can find solutions to problems. That's just not political rhetoric. I think people see that there are many, many problems on the horizon, healthcare being one of them. And I think this is a very innovative program with FEOP and something that we should look to invest in. And I'm going to be charging up a hill with a 2 cent per hour payroll assessment, if you will. Probably going to have to start in a house, and I think I can find a sponsor over there that would go dedicated specific to FEOP. But I think it's a good thing that we invest in. I think we need to bring employer groups back into a discussion about their participatory role in healthcare in Oregon. And I think, as far as I'm concerned as a Republican, I would rather mandate a 2 cent per hour payroll assessment or tax, or whatever you want to call it, as opposed to increasing their corporate income tax, because at least in this program, I know it's targeted to something that incents people to be more self-sufficient. So there's my dissertation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minister, my first remark is there anything that you recommend? My first recommendation is don't run for re-election. You have to deal with this. I mean, that'd be the easiest thing to do.
Talk into it, so.
Let me tell you what my thoughts are on that. I think the governor and the leadership have really set the stage for this. And the answer to this is the economy. You expand the economy, you get the economy, and I don't know how much control we as a state have over that as opposed to the national picture, but it's the economy. Business is thriving and good. They're hiring people. When they're hiring people, there's a labor shortage. One of the reasons you provide benefits is to recruit, retain. I think that we need to focus on how do we get that 300,000 or 400,000 people back into the private sector side. That doesn't answer the public sector side, the most vulnerable in some cases. But in the long run, if your private side deteriorates, your public side can't support it. You can't expand Medicaid, FEOP, to make up for an economy that is shrinking and a private sector that is serving fewer people each year rather than more. So my first advice is don't always get narrow onto health care. Get really wide on the economy, because that will address many of the problems. If our economy was booming, we wouldn't have this discussion today about some of the shortages. Now, for every crisis, however, there's an opportunity. Because the economy is contracted and put us in such crisis, and I think I am as sitting back looking at what the governor and the leadership and the legislature is doing, we'll always have politics, but I think the level of dialogue and debate and discussion is pretty positive right now. Every crisis is an opportunity, and that opportunity is to how can we pull the people into the same room and restructure this so that as we come out, we don't have a big gorilla that's unmanageable, but we have a gorilla that we agree from a policy standpoint and from a financing standpoint that we can support and through both good times and bad times. I don't have the answer, but other than this is an opportunity, I think, for the legislature and the governor to say what's going to be the base. In the meantime, Senator Walker, people are going to die. But if we don't solve the problem, then every time we go up and down, we're going to be in the same boat. the historical memory of the OHP and why it started. Senator Fisher was here, Senator Shields, you were here, Senator Minnis, but for most committees, you couldn't find three people that were there at the beginning.
I have a follow-up question to this. When times were good, we didn't create a rainy day fund. We did, however, during the special session, take a fund that was already created or set aside for education, and out of that fund, we did create what we now call a rainy day fund for education, which is locked in for education. Now, my question is, could we craft a rainy day fund for a health care program that would have the sufficient locks on the fund and be the type of thing that would kind of smooth that out? I thought of that based on some of the things that you're saying. We've got to look for solutions when, times are... This is the time when we have to start thinking about how we're going to avoid this the next time. When things are good, we don't want to do a rainy day fund because things are good. That's when we actually should do it. So, can you envision some kind of a set aside that would fill the gap when we need it?
Well, Mr. Chair, I have not had discussions with the governor and the governor's staff on this, but it seems to me that the governor has in the past endorsed and talked about being able to set aside funds to address this, and I think the legislative leadership has too. I think it's an issue of getting together and finding out how you're going to do it.
Wait a minute. Which governor are you talking about?
I think
about?
Governor Kulongowski.
He has in the past indicated that...
My sense and listen to him talk, and I've only had an opportunity to meet with him one time.
I guess what I'm asking, particularly of you, not of those of us who don't have the complete picture, you have a complete picture, and I would ask you to think about a mechanism where that could happen and would appeal to the broad spectrum of the political philosophy here, that there be some mechanism, if there is one, to do this. So I'm asking you to think about it.
Okay.
Yes. I want to kind of throw a little theoretical discussion out here. Workers' compensation insurance, when we did the reforms back when Neil was governor, we incented employers to pick up a certain portion of the cost. If you were injured, it was a minor injury, the employer takes care of it and pays the out-of-pocket expense, and I believe it's reported, and so on and so forth. But it didn't count against their experience in terms of injuries, and it didn't thus bump their rates up. Is there anything in health insurance that would cause a reduction in rate or cost if employers complied with certain types of health care practices or incented the employees to not engage in particular behaviors? We do this with auto insurance. Is that even the theoretical discussion in health insurance? Do you incent your employees to exercise, for instance?
And Ms. Chair, Senator Minnis, the only thing you can rate on under current law right now is age in terms of the group market. And, of course, obviously, number of people enrolled in the benefit package. But whether you have a whole bunch of employers who skydive or a whole bunch of employers who ski every weekend or smoke or not smoke or eat Twinkies, there could be a Twinkie tax, that doesn't get into any of the rating. One of the things that, and there was an agent just that I had emailed last week and said, I'm going to be appearing before some committees talking about the private sector. What is it that you would put on the table? And one of the things he said to me was incentives for wellness. And not so much for lifestyle, but participating in wellness activities. And we've got to be able to provide some incentives to both the employer and the employee for that. I think that's open to a lot of good ideas, and certainly more than I have, and a lot of people in the audience probably have better than I do.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm thinking of the union negotiations between the Portland Police Association and the City of Portland. With the health care cost premiums going up and the city is self-insured, the union looked at the experience rating of police officers and their consumption of health care product and found that they don't use as much. They don't get sick as often. They don't have to go to the doctor, so they don't consume as much of the product. And there's at least an assumption there that, they have exercise facilities in every one of the precincts. And there's this motivation, I think partly because of the work you're engaged in, to stay physically fit, because it can make the difference between whether you survive your job or not, the shift. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there may be some merit in looking at those kind of things and having a discussion with insurance companies about that.
I think of the SAFE fund as a rainy day fund for
something else.
Injured workers and people who pay rates, because the rate they got. I'm kind of disappointed that enough of it doesn't go to some of the injured workers, but certainly the rates go down, and that's about a couple billions of dollars. There must be some mechanism. The city of Springfield has a self-insured program, and they too have the exercise equipment, and they have tracked the deal, and it's phenomenal. I mean, they have avoided having to pay lots of extra.
We used to have this term, President Kennedy had a council on physical fitness. Mm-hmm. Didn't that go away for a period of time? Well, you're older than I am, that's why I'm asking you.
I won the President's Physical Fitness Award.
There you go.
When Lyndon Johnson took over after President Kennedy was shot.
Right.
And so
well,
it was during the 60s.
Here's the voice of experience who asked me to listen to that program. Okay, I will give a plug for a healthy... A Healthy Active Oregon. This is a conference that's going on at the Convention Center on February 11th, launching our statewide nutrition and physical activities program. Unless we have other questions, I will
thank you.
During the meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, don't turn your phone off.
No.